Thank you to the Cato Institute for having me. And I want to say that whoever designed the program, I assume it was Julian, but even if not, there's a kind of beautiful and disturbing flow here that you're going to see between the previous talk, my talk, and the next one. Because as you reflect on the panel that we just saw, and what I'm about to tell you, and then what Claire is probably going to present after me, I think it's worth thinking about. You know, we talk about sort of Palantir-style technologies, you know, the kind of data mining the police can do, data aggregation and so on, and we talk about facial recognition, these potentially very large data sets. Why is it that we're not seeing these, seemingly, show up in court cases? Why is it that we don't have judges ruling on these issues and telling us whether or not they think the use of these technologies is constitutional? Well, I suspect the answer to that question is because law enforcement and authorities in the federal government don't want judges to reach that question. And so they make sure that information doesn't show up in court records and it never gets litigated, it never gets decided, and often Congress doesn't find out about either, nor do we as members of the public. And so I'm going to talk to you today about a practice that Julian just described a bit, known as parallel construction. Parallel construction is actually going to be the subject of a very long, very detailed investigative report that we're hoping to publish as Human Rights Watch on about January 9th. It will have case samples. It will have some details that have not been reported. It will have interviews. It will have a lot of really meaty detail. What I'm going to be telling you today is really just a taste of that, so I would encourage you to keep an eye on our website. You can also check my Twitter feed around that time if you like, because we'll be publicizing that as much as possible. As I was saying in kind of discussing this with others in the run-up to this event, I think parallel construction is one of the most frightening civil liberties issues that you may never have heard of, which is why we did the project. So what is parallel construction? I'm using this term. So for the purposes of this discussion, I'm defining it as something that a government body does on purpose with the intention of concealing something else that it did to create an alternative. Like basically, it's the government creating on purpose an alternative explanation for how it found a piece of evidence. So it did thing A, but it doesn't want you to know that it did thing A. It doesn't want the defense attorney, for example, to know that it did thing A. So it goes back and does thing B. Something else. And then as far as it, you know, the story that presents in court is that the investigation started with thing B. So if that seems confusing, don't worry, we're going to go through it. In particular, I'm going to go through some hypothetical examples in just a moment. But another good place to start is an investigative article that Reuters published on this in August of 2013, really groundbreaking, where they report on a kind of secretive DEA unit, Drug Enforcement Administration unit, called the Special Operations Division, that's been heavily involved in this sort of thing. And so if you're looking for a place to start, this is really how our investigation got kicked off. And I think it's a good, concise resource on this as well. But some hypothetical examples of parallel construction, because I think it can be easier to wrap your mind around this by thinking about that than tackling the issue in the abstract. Of course, the difficulty with research and the kind of paradox is it's a concealment method. You're not supposed to know that it happened. That's the point. And so often we do wind up talking in hypotheticals because the entire idea is that not only are you not supposed to know about thing A, whatever it is they're trying to conceal, you're not supposed to know the concealment happened. So, but how might this work? So I took this one from an Intercept article that just came out the other day. The Intercept had this an article about immigration enforcement in Texas and how state troopers are starting to find people through traffic stops. And I thought, well, my gosh, to me, when somebody gets pulled over for having windows that are supposedly tinted too dark, and lo and behold, they have an immigration issue, that is kind of too happy for law enforcement, too happy for ICE to be a coincidence. And so an example of parallel construction you might have, totally hypothetical, is say the government has some very large database of phone records, as we know they have in the past, thanks to the Snowden revelations and also this some revelations that have come out about the DEA. Suppose they use those phone records to look at someone who they know is undocumented and say, who was that person in touch with? Who else do I think might be undocumented? Because they know that this might not sit well with the public, it might raise constitutional issues. They ask a local officer to pull over a car matching this description, a car they think belongs to the person that interests them. You know, so the officer goes, and they don't always tell the officer what they're looking for. So the officer goes, follows the car, you know, waits for it to drift over a lane line or waits for it to like not signal 20 feet before a turn or whatever the case might be, pulls the person over and then says, hey, you know, now that I've checked your license, et cetera, can I ask you a couple questions? You know, where do you live? How long have you lived there? You know, what's your nationality? And so on and so forth. And then as far as you know, as a defendant, that's how your case started, with the traffic stop. And you don't find out about this huge underlying program that might actually have be how the investigation of you started, and which might actually potentially render all this other stuff fruit of the poisonous tree. In other words, something that shouldn't be used in court because it was illegally obtained. But you're never going to know because the government is engaged in parallel construction and has created some other story about what it did to find you. Similar hypo, suppose the government secretly applies a new facial recognition technology to a video from a store security camera to identify a robbery suspect. And then it so identifies a suspect, and then it sends a human informant, you know, an undercover person, to their house to just sort of, or you know, to a street corner, or whatever, to just strike up a conversation, and start asking questions. And then suppose in the records that get filed in court, that's how that case started, with the human informant and the conversation. And you don't find out that the government may actually have used this facial recognition technology that may be biased, that may be inaccurate, that may draw on sets of data that are otherwise illegal or problematic. You don't know because the government has engaged in parallel construction. It did thing A, and then in order not to have to tell anybody about that, it went out and recreated the evidentiary trail. So that's parallel construction. So what's the problem? Well, aside from just, I think many of us are instinctively uncomfortable with the idea of covering up something the government did. It doesn't feel very democratic, and I think that's right. It shields the government conduct from constitutional scrutiny. You know, you'll never have a chance to have a court rule on whether that phone records program was constitutional, whether that facial recognition technology is constitutionally used. If courts never find out about it, you don't have that constitutional assessment that helps us draw those lines. So in U.S. court cases, if evidence was obtained illegally, courts will normally exclude it. They'll not allow the prosecution to introduce it into evidence. This is called the exclusionary rule, and the point of it is to deter law enforcement misconduct. Not necessarily in that particular case, because it's already happened in that case, but in the future. This is an incentive for the government, like from local level up to federal level, to comply with the law. But when you don't have those activities, when you don't have transparency as to what happened, when those things just happen in the dark, and they never have to come out, and you never have court scrutiny and potentially the exclusion of evidence as fruit of the poisonous tree, then you remove this deterrent for officials to obey the law. It can lead to coercion, perjury, and other problems. You think about the traffic stop scenario that I just talked about, hypothetically, where you have an officer who's been told, find a reason to pull this car over, and then find a way to start questioning this person, ideally find a way to make an arrest, or if it's a drug case, to search the car. If you're the officer, you may feel pressured to do those things, even where the Constitution would suggest and rulings would suggest that you've already crossed a line. You might illegally prolong a stop. You might illegally coerce someone. You might turn a Terry stop into an arrest unconstitutionally, a Terry stop being a kind of temporary detention that you're allowed to have during a traffic stop. And so you can see where, or officers might feel pressured to falsify reports or lie about what they did. I'm not in any way questioning the integrity of officers. What I'm saying is that I think parallel construction, the pressure to do this, this concealment, can create these pressures that can really lead to these problems down the road. And courts have observed this as well. It creates Brady problems. When you don't know, so Brady versus Maryland, is a Supreme Court case that says the government has to turn over any exculpatory evidence, any evidence it has that may be favorable to the defense. But if you don't know about this big collection of data, this big collection of evidence, or you don't know about the potential flaws in the software, you don't know the software was used, you can't analyze the software, you can't get the code, whatever the case might be, you may not be able to get at your Brady information, the information that might potentially be exculpatory, because again, you don't know that information might even be there. It may also violate notice requirements under some federal laws. There are a number of U.S. surveillance laws that have specific notification requirements. If you're surveilled under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, if you're surveilled under the Wiretap Act, you're supposed to get notice. But again, if the government thinks it doesn't have to tell you that any of that happened, then you're not going to get that. And you basically have the government not complying with the law, and again, you have these challenges not happening and potentially illegal behaviors going undetected and people possibly going to prison. And it also creates this, I wasn't able to say this in the report because it's sort of anecdotal and I don't have the proof, but you have a potentially unequal justice system. What I've heard anecdotally and seen anecdotally is that if you as a defendant have a savvy attorney who's wise to this stuff and is willing to file the motions and push hard and even risk displeasure with the judge, you are more likely to suddenly get a more favorable plea offer from the prosecution or have your case dropped. If you're a defendant who doesn't happen to have that savvy attorney, those things are not going to happen for you. And so you create these inequities in the justice system based on kind of how in the know your attorney potentially is about these practices. And that's a concern as well. So why does the government legally think it can do this? I realize this audience is not entirely lawyers, and so I'm going to try to tone this down a bit. But basically, there are some, the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine that I just talked about, this idea that the government does something illegal, things that kind of flow from that behavior, evidence that gets down the line as a result of that behavior is thought of as fruit of the poisonous tree. It's fruit of that illegal activity. There are exceptions to this. For example, where you have what the US Supreme Court has said is a genuinely independent source of the information, or you would inevitably have found it in some other way, then you're allowed to get it in. The problem here is that you have the government deciding for itself, oh, we had an independent source of the information, or oh, we would have found this anyway, when actually that's supposed to be the judge's role to decide whether that's true or not. And so you have the government kind of taking this on for itself, and we don't have copies of their legal theories, but we can kind of guess that this is why they think they can do this. There's some other case laws that we're going to discuss in the report if you're interested. For traffic stops, there's some judicially developed doctrines, including something called collective knowledge that the Supreme Court has not really blessed, and that I'm actually, for the sake of time, not going to get into. There's a case called Wren that says when an officer pulls you over for a traffic stop, it doesn't matter what their subjective motivation was, if they just didn't like the look of your car or, you know, what they had for lunch that day disagreed with them. That doesn't matter. What matters is whether you committed the traffic violation. To the government, that means, apparently, that all anything that happened before that traffic stop doesn't matter. And so to the government, it doesn't really matter if there was some surveillance program that led to the tip, that led to the traffic stop. You know, the traffic, you made the traffic violation, which everybody does, and I think somebody else observed on this panel, or previously over lunch perhaps, that we all routinely engage in petty acts of criminality, right, without necessarily meaning to or knowing it. And so to the government, as long as you have that broken taillight, or you didn't signal before the lane change, everything else that came before doesn't matter. And so the government kind of basically wipes out everything that came before that point, owing to a Supreme Court case that said actually nothing of the sort, didn't really touch that issue at all. But this is what seems to justify it to them. What could the government seek to conceal through parallel construction? Well, potentially anything, and I mean really anything. Could be a wiretap with a warrant that they just don't want to disclose at that point. Could be a human source. Could be a gigantic NSA program or a gigantic DEA program. Once you have this technique available to you, you could be using it to conceal anything that you don't want the public to know or that you don't want the defense attorney to know, as long as you can kind of justify it to yourself. For intelligence surveillance, I'm not going to get bogged down in the details of U.S. intelligence surveillance laws, but just to briefly say, Executive Order 12333, as many people in this room will know, has been the underpinning of very, very large surveillance programs disclosed by Snowden, warrantless, no judicial oversight whatsoever, no judicial authorization whatsoever, even at a kind of top-line systemic level. John Napier Tai, a State Department whistleblower, published a Washington Post op-ed in 2014 implying that the government, for example, might get the audio of U.S. telephone calls warrantlessly through 12333. And so this is something I think about, you know, the potential scale of 12333 programs versus suddenly, for some reason, we never see an indictment that mentions 12333. We never see a criminal complaint that mentions 12333. And why is that? Again, I would ask the same question of the data mining technologies, the Palantir predictive policing technologies that we just talked about. Why is it that that doesn't seem to be showing up in indictments and complaints? I'm going to talk about just two other things, because they're things I think people don't think about often enough, including in the surveillance space. Intelligence sharing arrangements. Not all the surveillance data the U.S. government gets is necessarily from its own agencies, such as the NSA or the National Reconnaissance Organization or the DEA, whatever. It could be from a foreign partner, such as the UK or Mexico. And so this is actually a quote from Ron Wyden, who put this in a written question to Mike Pompeo, now the CIA director, back in January during the confirmation hearing, pointing out that the U.S. government thinks that it can't ask another country to turn over data that the U.S. could not legally gather, but it can sit back and receive anything. And so Ron Wyden says, even if the CIA doesn't specifically request something, a foreign government could just turn over anything, including bulk collection on Americans. And, you know, as with anything Ron Wyden says, I think you have to assume that he's trying to call our attention to something that is probably happening that he's not actually allowed to tell us is happening. And so that's something I want to think about, too. If you could have these huge intelligence sharing arrangements, why don't the stories of cases start more often with, we got data from the UK, we got data from Mexico, we got data from Colombia? This is blurry. I won't go into detail on national security letters. I just think this is an amazing slide. We got this through a Freedom of Information Act request and published it in October. national security letters, these warrantless FBI demands for data in certain types of cases. They go to providers and say, you know, turn over whatever. And also, we're not going to, we're going to give you a gag order so that you can't tell anybody that you got the NSL. So the, what this slide illustrates, and unfortunately you really can't see, is the range of entities to which the FBI can give these national security letters to demand information. They range from travel agencies, car salespeople, casinos, jewelers, the postal service, insurance companies, banks, savings and loan companies, credit cards, credit unions, all of this. Did I say casinos? You know, these potential recipients of NSLs. And again, we're not. They can get data from all these entities, but we don't see this show up in indictments. So how does the government actually conceal this? I talked a little bit, about pretextual traffic stops or maybe sending a human informant somewhere. The Classified Information Procedures Act is something we're going to talk about a little bit in the report. It's a kind of, they're ex parte hearings where the defense, I think, probably never, at least usually does not participate, where the prosecution can basically take classified information and have the judge approve a kind of scrubbed or redacted version. And so the sanitization of information through SEPA hearings is one way, sorry, SEPA proceedings is one way this might happen. They can go get what's called a regular FISA warrant and kind of avoid sort of the more controversial intelligence surveillance programs by doing something that's somewhat less controversial, but where the application usually remains sealed and not available to the public or the defense. They could go get subpoenas for call records, doesn't require a warrant. They could ask for consent to search. We're going to report on a New Mexico case where a DEA agent was alone on a bus for a really long period of time. And then when it was during a layover in Albuquerque. And then when passengers reboarded the bus, the DEA agents walked right up to one guy and said, hey, can we check your bag? You know, can we check out your bag? And so what they're doing is they're looking for consent to search because that can provide a legal basis to do a search. When the defense alleged that they had already secretly on the bus and illegally probably opened the bag or felt around and decided they thought it contained something suspicious. And that person was convicted. Use of publicly available information. There was a case in Southern District of Ohio that I don't think got enough play where, as far as the FBI said, it was a case of someone who supposedly had gave material support to ISIS. And the FBI said, well, we found the Twitter feed. It's like, well, of all the Twitter feeds in the world, you know, you found that one. And then later you have John Boehner come out and trumpet that FISA was involved. This is why we need to keep FISA. And I assume he was talking about Section 702. It's not explicit, you know, but this is why it's so important to renew this law. But again, that's not anywhere in the complaint or the indictment or any of the court records. The government is telling you this is coming from publicly available information. But what if that's not how the case started? So I think that the main point I want to make and where I'll conclude is, if parallel construction is legal, does the Bill of Rights still have any meaning? If the government can do activities that are constitutionally questionable or that it should know are unlawful, and then simply never tell anyone, including people who are at risk of losing their liberty, going to prison potentially for a very long time, then do those rights still have any meaning? If the government can just not tell anyone that it did something that was questionable under the Fourth Amendment, if you never find out about those data collections so you can't assert your Fifth Amendment rights to exculpatory evidence under Brady, you know, or what if the government, someone, somewhere, in some law enforcement body, decides they're going to run an investigative program that singles out people based on race or based on First Amendment protected activities? Those things will not come to light if the government isn't made to tell about them, if it thinks it can just legally conceal them. And so I think this is very, very frightening. You know, and also that you'll never have a remedy for abuses. Whoops, I think, so as I said, that's where I'm going to conclude, but I think hopefully it'll provide a nice segue into the next session about facial recognition technology. But I invite anybody in the audience who has questions about this or comments about it to approach me afterward, because frankly, I love to talk about this, and please do look for the report, which comes out in January. Thank you.
All right, hi everyone. I'm Claire Garvey. I'm with the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. We put out a report last year titled The Perpetual Lineup, looking at how state and local law enforcement agencies use face recognition technology. This was something that was not widely known. There was a fair amount of information about how the FBI uses the technology, but virtually no information about how state and local agencies, whether they have this technology, and if they do, how they use it, and maybe more importantly, whether there are any limits placed on the use of the technology. So I want you to imagine for a second that you're home at night, it's maybe 8 p.m., and the police knock on your door, and they say, there's been a robbery in the neighborhood. Don't worry, we think we have the person who did it in custody. However, We want you to come down to the station and stand in a lineup. Would you please do that for us? I think a lot of us, if that instance was presented to us, we would say no. There are a lot of concerns there. One, it's kind of a pain in the neck to go down to the police station. But maybe more concerningly, you might be thinking, I must look a lot like this guy. What if the witness points to me instead of the real suspect? Well, the reality is, thanks to face recognition, 53% of all American adults, at least, are now in what we call a perpetual lineup. This is a law enforcement face recognition network. Virtue of the fact, not that they have had prior interaction with law enforcement, but because they have a driver's license. So that's probably one in two of all of you in this room today. So I'm going to go through the three main findings of our report. And that fact I just mentioned is part of our first finding, that the use of face recognition technology by law enforcement is far more pervasive and far more advanced than certainly we were expecting and that most people realize. Our second finding is that the use of face recognition technology by police will have a disparate impact on African American communities. And our third finding is that law enforcement face recognition is very much not under control. So as a preliminary, I want to just briefly go through how face recognition is used by police today. The first is what we call stop and identify. A handful of agencies across the country have face recognition applications on their phones, which mean that officers in the field, after they've stopped somebody, can actually look up that person's identity with a face recognition application simply by taking their picture. This process takes about 3 seconds. Then there's arrest and identify. Upon arrest, in most jurisdictions that have a face recognition system, the person arrested, regardless of whether they're charged or later convicted, will have their face print taken, their mugshot taken. That photo will then be searched against the existing database and enrolled into the mugshot face recognition database for future searches. The third is investigate and identify, and this is the one that our report focuses the most on and that is the assumed instance for the rest of this presentation. That is, let's say officers have a surveillance video of a bank robbery taking place or a cell phone camera video of a theft, something like that. They can take that photo, and if there's a good enough face in any of those stills, they can run that through a face recognition system and search for that individual against whatever database they have. The fourth and most concerning application of face recognition that we're seeing is real-time biometric surveillance. Face recognition is a biometric. It can be collected remotely and in secret. Increasingly, what we're seeing is law enforcement agencies expressing interest in using face recognition at the back end of CCTV systems in real time to monitor who's walking by those cameras. The other component of face recognition that we need to talk about briefly is who's in the database. Who can we actually search for? The first and most common form are mugshot databases. But as I said before, this is not necessarily limited to individuals convicted of a crime. This is in all jurisdictions but one, in Michigan. This is any individual who was arrested, regardless of whether or not they were charged or later convicted. Increasingly, however, driver's license photo databases are optimized for face recognition searchability, and now they are open to search by law enforcement agencies. The final form of database that we talk about are watch lists or hot lists. These are individuals that a real-time system would be looking for. Right now, because of technological limitations, these are a very narrow list of individuals. While the technological limitations are being overcome, the narrowness, the targeted nature of these types of watch lists is going to disappear, and the databases are increasingly going to look like this for real-time systems as well. So this brings me to our first finding, that law enforcement is far more advanced and widespread than most people realize. The GAO report early last year indicated that the FBI actually has access to search 16 states' driver's license photos for FBI criminal investigations, representing 64 million people across the country. Our report includes state and local law enforcement access to driver's license photos, and that number jumps up to 26 states and 117 million people as of the launch of our report. We're continuing to investigate, and this number is just, it continues to grow. We're now at 30 states and 119 million people, which is 53% of all American adults are in a face recognition law enforcement network. So how advanced is it? I heard in some of the other panels we've been talking about how minority report have we gotten. Well, the idea to biometrically surveil public spaces to me is as minority report as you can get. And what we found is six, probably seven major jurisdictions across the country have either looked into or actually purchased the ability to do real-time face recognition surveillance. This is Seattle, Los Angeles, Dallas, Chicago, New York, West Virginia, and probably Detroit. And every major company that sells face recognition systems to law enforcement in the US advertise the ability to do so and heavily, heavily market it as well. Our second finding is that law enforcement face recognition will have a disparate impact on African Americans. This is because of three factors. The first is, who is this used on? This is a slide from San Diego looking at the use of license plate readers and face recognition technology. There are three very shocking statistics on here. I'm focusing on the last one, that people of color were between 1.5 and 2.5 times more likely to be targeted than expected by their presence in the population. And this is license plate readers and face recognition specifically. The second prong is, who's in the database. Most face recognition systems at least run on mugshots. And if we look at arrest to population ratios, these are vastly disproportionate for African Americans in terms of arrest rates than their proportion of the population would suggest. So African Americans are overrepresented in both the searches, the probe photos, the photos that the law enforcement agencies are seeking to identify, and in the databases themselves. And the third prong is the search itself. Taking a step back, face recognition is not very accurate. It's an imperfect biometric, which is understandable because it is collected remotely. There are a lot of variables. A few years ago, the FBI ran a test on the searches that they conduct and found that it was about 86% accurate, meaning that six out of seven of the searches they ran, the suspect who was indeed in the database would show up in a list of possible of 2 to 50 possible candidates. But one out of seven searches would result in a list of completely innocent candidates, even though the suspect was in their database. But compounding this, the fact is that the errors are not distributed evenly. A 2012 study co-authored by the FBI face recognition expert found that face recognition algorithms are 5 to 10% less accurate on African Americans, women, and young people. More recent NIST studies continue to demonstrate that these algorithms perform differently depending on your demographics, particularly race and gender. A confounding factor here is that agencies and, to an extent, the companies themselves don't fully acknowledge this fact, so it's not being addressed. This is from a Seattle system, an FAQ about their system, where they say, well, it's not racist because it doesn't see race. But the problem is, a race-blind system is not a race-neutral system. And there's a failure in the face recognition deployment by law enforcement to recognize that. Our third finding is that law enforcement face recognition, however pervasive, however advanced it is not under control. We first took a look at any possible legislative controls and found that there are no comprehensive state or federal laws that govern the use of this technology by law enforcement. We then took a look at the policies. We took a look at the executive side, if you will, how the agencies themselves are choosing to regulate this, and found that there are a very limited number of agencies had policies to begin with, Very few of those existing policies required individualized suspicion, limited the searches to certain crimes, required suspicion to begin with, prohibited searches on political and First Amendment protected activities, and the other things listed here. Many agencies told us in our FOIA, in our records requests responses, that they didn't have a manual. They didn't have any rules governing how the technology is used. Some policies went even further than that to say that law enforcement is encouraged to use face recognition, encouraged to use this technology whenever practical. That line is from the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office. We went down and talked to Sheriff Galtieri there, who's been in operation of the longest running system in the country. It's been in operation since 2001. This system that's been in operation for about 16 years has never been audited, despite the fact that about 8,000 searches are run on this system every year. Well, this leads to one last question, which Sarah covered pretty well, but is there any judicial control here? We went across the street and spoke to Bob Dillinger, who's the public defender for Pinellas County, and he said never in his entire time running the public defender's office, which and he's been around for the entire duration of the face recognition program, never has any case had face recognition disclosed as Brady evidence. This is something one would expect, because if face recognition gives a list of possible candidates, any candidate who's listed by the algorithm who is not the person charged would potentially be exculpatory evidence that must be turned over to the defense. It doesn't happen. So no legislative control, no executive control, no judicial control or oversight. We also see that this is something that may be leading to chilling free speech. There is an instance in Baltimore after the death of Freddie Gray in police custody. The Baltimore County Police Department used Geofedia and purportedly used it in conjunction with face recognition to take the photographs from the public protests, run them through face recognition, and identify people at protest sites while the demonstrations were going on. Law enforcement agencies themselves have said in a 2011 report that this runs the risk of chilling free speech, of leading to social control, and yet that hasn't stopped them from using it with no limits. Our report has a number of calls to action. In the interest of time, I'm not going to give an in-depth look at this, but we make recommendations to legislatures at the federal and state level, to the FBI and to state and local law enforcement, to NIST and other technical researchers, to companies, to community leaders. Our report has a model face recognition legislation, a use policy, some questions to ask, and individual state sheets breaking down what we found in certain jurisdictions. There is reason for optimism. The House Oversight Committee did hold a hearing after the launch of our report on the use of face recognition technology, in which they very much put the FBI in the hot seat over its lack of transparency and oversight. We've seen action in Vermont, Maryland, and New York, including the introduction of what would have been a comprehensive bill in Maryland. But so that we don't end on too optimistic of a note, I do want to talk about two quick points about where this technology is going. What are we going to see in the future? The first is the issue of body cameras. This face recognition, real-time face recognition use in conjunction with body cameras is coming. It's already in use in the UK. The company who deploys it in the UK has a contract here to use it with dash cams, so it is coming. Think about this. Real-time face recognition, where the final arbiter of the face recognition decision, of the algorithmic match of a face, is not somebody sitting behind a desk who has the time and training to evaluate whether the algorithm's right or not. It's an officer in the field with a weapon who has a moment decision to make whether he's faced with a threat to public safety, whether he needs to draw his gun. What if the algorithm's wrong? The other point I want to raise is that to look at the applications elsewhere as possible premonition of what we could see in the US. China is very aggressively deploying face recognition technology on very minor crimes. They use it on jaywalking, not only to shame jaywalkers, but to report that crime to the police when it occurs. We see the Russian government very actively using face recognition to crack down on anti-corruption and anti-government protesters. They threaten it, and they do use it. They'll publish the protesters' names online and subject them to harassment, if not arrest and incarceration. And then a final note on real-time surveillance. China has 200 million cameras. They're planning to implement 400 million more in the coming years. They have real-time face recognition in a lot of these cameras. The BBC just announced, or just did a video on this, where they had the system enroll the face of one of their correspondents, and he was found within 7 minutes of walking out the door by the face recognition system. This is far more advanced than what we're seeing in the United States today, but the reason why I end on this note is that without restrictions, without laws in place to limit these systems, without the transparency, without public knowledge about how these systems are being deployed, there are very few practical limitations on an agency deciding to take this route, deciding to purchase this, and the companies are more than willing to sell the technology. So the information can be found about our report, and our report itself can be found at perpetuallineup.org. I'll be sticking around for questions as well. I'm happy to talk more about this with anyone who's interested.
Hi, everyone. I'm Alvaro Bedoya, and together with Rachel Levinson Waldman, we will be talking about the digital Muslim ban. So you've heard about the Muslim ban. What is the digital Muslim ban? Well, it begins with President Trump's original travel ban issued on January 27th, 2017. When the travel ban came out, most people focused on the country bars, the bars on travel and immigration from a certain set of Muslim-majority countries. But there was a different section of the order, Section 4A, which called for screening of every traveler coming to the United States for three criteria: whether they intended to commit a crime or terrorist act, whether they would contribute to American society, whether they'd be a positively contributing member of society, and whether they were able to make contributions to the national interest. Now, for the folks who were paying attention, for the experts, they were baffled by this order. Why? Because first of all, the United States does an awful lot of screening already to figure out who's a criminal or who's a terrorist and prevent them from coming into the country. But perhaps most importantly, because those other two criteria exist nowhere in American immigration law. They are effectively made out of whole cloth. There's no definition for what it means to positively contribute to American society, for example. So this came out, this caused a little bit of tumult. But then, as you probably all remember, President Trump rescinded the original travel ban. And with it, those first two criteria to screen people whether they would be contributing members of society and whether they would further the national interest, those were not included in the later travel bans, in the later Muslim bans. Fast forward to July 2017. What happens in July 7, 2017 is that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, posts online procurement documents for a contract, for a system, to build a system that they call the Extreme Vetting Initiative. So, what's the Extreme Vetting Initiative? The documents reveal the Extreme Vetting Initiative to be a system that will screen travelers to the United States to determine if they will, first, commit a criminal or terrorist act, second, contribute to American society, and third, further the national interests. If that sounds familiar, you are paying attention, because the original criteria from that first Muslim ban were reproduced almost verbatim in this system, in this extreme vetting system. So how on earth are they going to vet people for these criteria? How on earth is this contractor going to actually vet people to answer these questions? Well, the first way the contractor will do it is automatically and on an ongoing basis. What do I mean by that? Right now, the vetting that occurs at DHS is predominantly manual and occurs at discrete points in time. It occurs when someone applies at their local consulate for admission, for a visa. And it occurs again when they enter the country. They have an interview from a CBP agent, officer. And sometimes it'll occur if you are on a visa and you commit a crime. That usually sends up an alert through various systems that have actually been discussed here into ICE. What Extreme Vetting Initiative will do, what the Extreme Vetting Initiative will do, is do that automatically on an ongoing basis. But then you might ask, how actually are they going to do that on an ongoing basis? What are they literally going to do? Well, a big part of that is social media monitoring and social media analysis. And ICE puts a fine point on it. They specifically say they want this contractor to scan all publicly available information, such as media, blogs, public hearings, conferences, academic websites, social media websites. You wonder which ones? Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, radio, television, press, for relevant information. At this age, you might be thinking, how on earth are they going to figure out whether someone's going to contribute to American society based on looking at their Facebook page? Well, machine learning. And this is a little tongue-in-cheek, but a lot of the vendors who showed up at this ICE Industry Day in July 2017 specialized in data mining and machine learning. And one of them asked ICE point blank, do you want us to use machine learning capabilities to evaluate these people for example, whether they will be contributing members of society? And the ICE unit said, yes, we are interested in acquiring these capabilities. Now, if at this point you are wondering, hey, maybe, you know, I could see how there might be a very narrowly targeted program that looks to see if people on tourist visas have posted known ISIS videos. Okay, maybe I could see how that might fit into this with some hyperbole in the contract documents. That is not what this is. This under this contract, the vendor is required, no matter what, to flag 10,000 people annually for investigations for deportation and visa denial, regardless, effectively, of the merits of those leads. Now, someone else in the audience might be thinking, well, okay, I'm comfortable with checking tourists. They don't have a right to come in the country. I'm fine with just looking at tourists. But Americans and people who live here already, that's a different question. Well, you're going to be disappointed, or maybe you'll, well, what language should you pay attention to here? ICE basically reserves the right to do this vetting on legal permanent residents. The procurement documents basically bemoan the fact that ongoing vetting isn't conducted on legal permanent residents after they're granted that status. And when a vendor asked them point blank, hey, do you want us to do this for legal permanent residents? They said, we'll tell you later. Now, if there's folks from industry here, or folks who are familiar with industry's take on the use of their platforms as basically pools of information for surveillance, you might remember that a couple months ago, Facebook actually closed down its API for surveillance purposes and issued a policy saying, hey, we don't want you to use our platform for surveillance. We're changing our policies. A vendor raised this to ICE and said, hey, you mentioned Facebook. You want us to look at Facebook. Didn't Facebook make its API private? Do you still want us to look at Facebook? And I said, yes, we want you to look at Facebook. We want you to exploit all publicly available information, including Facebook. And separately, they actually talked about finding workarounds for these kinds of protections that are in place. And I'll put an asterisk there. We're not really sure what this means, but we know that ICE wants to get at this information. This is a very broad program that's going to automatically scan the internet and automatically flag a minimum of 10,000 people a year for investigations for deportation and visa denial. And it is still going through the contracting process. Recently, its name was changed from the Extreme Vetting Initiative to the Visa Lifecycle Vetting Program. But we prefer to call it the Digital Muslim Ban. And for that, I'll turn it over to Rachel.
Great. Thank you, Alvaro. And what I want to talk about is the concerns about the Extreme Vetting Initiative, Visa Lifecycle Vetting, Digital Muslim Ban, a lot of which were alluded to in kind of the foundation that Alvaro was laying about where this comes from, what the language is in it. And I just want to kind of go into detail and unpack those a little bit. So the first concern is that it is basically impossible. So one of the things that the Brennan Center and Georgetown Center on Privacy and Technology did, working together with a bunch of organizations, was get together a couple of different groups of experts to send letters to the then acting Secretary of DHS. There's now a new sort of official secretary. So one of those letters, these letters went out the week before Thanksgiving. The first was from a group of over 50 technological experts. So these were people who have expertise in math, computer science, machine learning, engineering, coming from places including MIT, Google, Stanford, Microsoft Research, Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, a big, big range from academia and the tech world and research labs to say, what ICE wants to do is technologically impossible. And that comes from one of the things that Alvaro had alluded to, which was that the terminology in this initiative that ICE is asking vendors to build, that terminology is totally absent of any understood meaning, any understood sort of objective meaning. So one of the things the experts said was there are no computational methods that can provide reliable or objective assessments of the traits that ICE wants to measure. What would it mean to determine if somebody is going to make a positive contribution to society or a contribution to the national interest? And in the absence of any objective understanding of what those things mean, there are going to be proxies that are put in place. So who knows what those proxies will be? ICE certainly hasn't said, and it's not clear who's going to come up with those, but it could be something like income. It could be whether somebody has a job or not. It could be familial status. It certainly could be, based on what ICE has said that it wants vendors to look at, it could be the statements that they put up on social media or elsewhere. But almost regardless of what's put in place for that, this simply won't work the way ICE wants it to work. And just to briefly flag two pieces. So one of them is this issue about whether there's any kind of objective assessment of those contribution terms that ICE used. The other, as you may remember, is that ICE also wants to predict who might be likely to engage in a criminal or terrorist act. And that is extremely difficult to impossible to predict as well, especially when you're talking about terrorist acts, which is obviously what sort of supposedly animates the Muslim ban. Thankfully, terrorist acts are extremely, extremely rare. And it's really widely acknowledged across the spectrum from any experts that when you have something that is as rare as a terrorist act, there's no way to simply add factors into a system and have it come out, bloop, bleep, this is who we think might commit a terrorist act. So first problem, it won't work. The second problem is how discriminatory this is likely to be. So as Alvaro talked about, this really comes out of the first travel ban, the first Muslim ban. That was one that was enjoined by the courts. One court said that it drips with religious intolerance, animus, and discrimination. And the extreme vetting language more broadly, as you may remember when now President Trump was on the campaign trail, he started off talking about a Muslim ban and then kind of shifted to this extreme vetting language, including the fact that in the second presidential debate in October 2016, he said quite explicitly, the Muslim ban has morphed into extreme vetting. So he and the administration clearly see this as being of a piece. And so there is this real concern that it is, in fact, basically a digital Muslim ban. And not only that, it's across the background of derogatory statements about wide swaths of immigrants. So certainly the concern about Muslim communities sort of first and foremost in light of where this comes from. But there have been derogatory statements, and there are really concerning policies that are being built on discrimination against groups of immigrants, certainly groups of immigrants coming from Central and South America as well. So there are a whole variety of ways that this could be used and seems quite likely to be used in the absence of any objective criteria as a tool for discrimination. The third concern is the chilling effect that this is almost certain to have. So thinking again about the language that ICE said, that ICE told vendors, we want you to build a system that will monitor social media online, press, radio, TV, academic websites, the incredibly broad internet sites, which is the last term in that, which seems to be really sort of suffice as a catch-all for anything online. So in some ways, sort of a natural response to that, if you are somebody who is applying for a visa or is here on a work visa, a student visa, a travel visa, in some ways the rational reaction to that would be to watch what you are posting online, to think carefully about, is this going to raise flags for somebody? Is it going to raise flags if I join a certain group, if I'm active in a certain group, if I correspond with certain people, if I post certain articles, if I make certain statements, right? I have reason to believe that the government is going to be watching all those things and is going to be making determinations that I don't understand and nobody else understands to make determinations about whether I can stay in the country. So it seems almost inevitable to have a chilling effect for people who are coming to the country, and also I suspect a chilling effect in terms of who decides to come here in the first place. So for people who might have been thinking of coming as students, coming as foreign scholars, coming as faculty members, coming to maybe do a collaborative program with a government agency, they may simply decide, you know what, the risks are too high, either of my being deported unexpectedly or simply of spending my entire time here feeling as though I am under a microscope and deciding not to come. And the final piece, you know, we've been talking about this in the context of foreign visitors. Obviously, this arises in the context of visa vetting and continuous vetting once foreign visitors are in the country. But it is inevitably going to have an impact on US citizens as well. There is no way that a system built to monitor, in effect, the entire internet can pick up only information about foreign visitors and not information about Americans. One of the examples that Alvaro uses is, you know, there's not sort of an American's Facebook and a foreigner's Facebook, an American's Twitter and a foreigner's Twitter. There's not an American's internet and a foreigner's internet. There is no way to collect this information without sweeping in really a huge amount of U.S. citizens' materials as well. And so there are real questions about what happens with that? Where is it stored? How is it used? And then those same chilling effects, I think, are going to come into play for American citizens as well, who are thinking to themselves, I would be corresponding with foreign visitors, working with them, getting to know them, socializing with them, corresponding with them online, and making the same determinations that foreign visitors are likely to about simply not doing some of that activity, both online and in real life. So that closes out sort of the overview of the Extreme Vetting Initiative. I want to say briefly, we don't have a slide about this, but if you're interested in learning more, there's a resource page on the Brennan Center website. If you Google Brennan Center Extreme Vetting Initiative or Brennan Center EVI resource page, you'll get to a resource page that has a lot of information on it. So it has all of the background documents that ICE put up. It has the letters that I mentioned that went out from both a group of technologists and a group of civil society organizations. It has a link to a petition that went to IBM. It has links to all of the press. And as more happens, and more will be happening, this is really the beginning of a campaign on this, raising public education, and also hopefully shaming DHS into dropping this plan and companies into deciding not to build the system. And as that progresses, there will be more information on that site as well. So please check it out and feel free to get in touch with me, either me or Alvaro. Thank you.